It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's conversation, we're going to be talking about how our guest teaches drawing to help people slow down and notice so much more, connecting with their subject matter and providing moments of mindfulness and presence. Our guest loves to see people have moments of insight about what they're looking at, and see the joy that comes from honing their drawing skills. Her work with arts and science in one through the Cambridge Public Schools trains adult volunteers to work with fourth and fifth graders on nature journaling as a way of honing the students' observational skills, their connection to nature, and their ability to draw and write about what they observe. And with us today for the conversation is Erica Bead, illustrator and educator. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you, Mark.
This is really, it's so great to hear about that what you're trying to do, I would say, is get people to see. Am I right?
Yeah, that's really at the heart of it, I think, to see and to appreciate, I think, what's around them, particularly in the natural world around them, wherever they are.
So how does your art and your teaching as an educator in those visual arts, how does it help people to be better able to look? What are the kind of the key ideas in there?
So I think one of the key things is just that slowing down piece. I think more and more it's difficult to slow down, to take the time to really look at things. I feel like many of us, and myself included, fight with sort of being in your head instead of being kind of present in the world. And also, I think life can start to feel like a bunch of to-do lists, and so I think it can be helpful to have, in order to slow down to look, to have the drawing be part of it, to know that you're going to have to take time to look closely in order to actually record what you see, to get at something, to capture something of what you see. You're going to need to look in a different way, and you're going to need to slow down.
And so by its very nature, right, you're sitting there. So I imagine that if I'm sketching, I'm sitting there and I have something that is probably moving. I mean, even if it's a plant, it's moving in the wind and stuff. So I've got to look intensely at each moment and then kind of sketch pretty quickly. But then later I can slow that down, right? So there's this kind of what you do in the field or what you do from a reference, mm-hmm. like a real object in a museum or a drawing. But you are looking back and forth at this thing multiple times.
Yeah, and it helps because sometimes even the fact that things are moving and that you're outside and that there's lots of distractions can in some ways be helpful because you need to look at things differently. You need to not look at what you're looking at, through the lens of your preconceived ideas about it. You know, this is a rabbit. This is a daisy, whatever it is. You need to start to think in terms of shapes and angles and proportions. And the positive shapes, the shapes of things themselves, but also the shapes around and between things. And I think that can be really a great practice to get into that forces you to be present and forces you to look through slightly different lenses at the world.
Yeah, I was just having, I take people on journaling hikes, and I just had somebody ask a really, really interesting question because we were talking about that positive and negative. And it was a good question because they said, well, there's stuff in the negative, and there is, like there's sky or there's clouds or whatever. But what do you mean when you talk about positive and negative space? Because I guess they're interchangeable depending on where I'm looking or what I'm trying to capture. But how do you describe that?
I've never gotten that question. That's a great question. Yeah, there's so much going on that is within those little windows of space. So So then you have to focus on the thing that you're most interested in getting down the information about, you know, the thing that you maybe want to record or you want to share with someone else, and focus mainly on that. And then maybe think about how those things that appear in those windows, well, how do you want to treat those? You may treat them, you know, you may exclude them, but you may also bring them in and bring them in differently, you know, with lighter lines or with simpler, you know, with fewer details, or, you know, all sorts of ways of changing the focus.
Yeah, much like you do with photography, right? So if I imagine there's a hole in a tree, I mean, a dead tree, it goes all the way through, and I'm looking through that hole or in a log that's down, I have the outline work that I can do all around the app, which would be the, at that point, the positive space would be the log.
Right.
But I can also have a little window into a whole other scene through the little hole. And I can now think of what's in there as positive, and the tree being as the negative around the outside of that to frame it. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that's what's really cool about it, that these things for us create windows.
Totally does. Yeah. And it makes you aware of how your brain is processing things, which is one of the things that really fascinates me, is the process of drawing and the process that we go through in translating something into two dimensions. And so that idea that you know, you control the focus in your drawing, you control where the viewer looks, and you can play with it in wonderful ways, just like with photography. You can you know, bring unexpected things to the fore if you want to through those windows.
Yeah. And, you know, photography is so fast. You can just clip, you know, take a snap of a photo, be gone. But what you're talking about is slow. So it's long time. You're taking time to keep looking at it. And in the course of doing that, do you find yourself seeing other things that weren't the main subject? And that, not that you take over that has, that doesn't take over your drawing, but mm-hmm. you start to see other things. You go, oh, that's pretty cool. I wouldn't have seen that had I not been sitting here for so long.
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things that's most exciting to me, is that the more you sit in front of something and draw it, the more you notice that you know, you would never have seen if you had taken that time to slow down. And sometimes, you know, you could be drawing a plant and then insects start to visit the plant, and you start to wonder about all sorts of things about, you know, what's that relationship between those insects and the plant? And then you notice the wind and seeds moving through the wind. And it's just I sort of think of this hidden worlds idea. You know, the more you look, the more you realize that there are so many worlds within worlds going on around us. And it's just one of those things that I think makes life exciting, you know, is that it's not just the surface. There's all those other things. So drawing does help you see those things in a new way.
Yeah. And one of the things I love about your work, and I, you know, I had the real pleasure of being able to take an online class with, you know, just one workshop with you. It was really great, which is how I got to know about you. But one of the things that was really great in there is, unlike photography, what you do is you do capture it 2D, but you actually capture it with depth. So that's the magic of illustration and drawing, right? And painting, is you can add the three dimensions back in, which a photograph can't do. Photograph is always flat two dimensions, but you're able to, in your painting, to simulate something that makes you feel like there's depth and shape and form.
Yeah, I really think of that as the magic tricks part of drawing. You know, the you're creating an illusion on the page, and it's fun to watch, especially when working with little kids. If you show them even a little trick that helps things go from being two-dimensional to three-dimensional, it's so empowering for them. It's like suddenly knowing how to pull an egg out of somebody's ear. You know, it's like sleight of hand. First, it's flat, and then, you know, you add a little tone, and you suddenly it feels like you could reach into the paper and pick something up. And that's just, I think, totally magical. And there's so much to learn in order to do it. The other thing about that is that more and more I realize how much, when you do that, when you shade a drawing, you create the illusion of depth or create the illusion of volume. It's not just you doing it. The person looking at your drawing is a collaborator in doing that. And so everybody's going to see it a little differently, but you can even just suggest the slightest bit of, you know, shading on something, and the person looking at it is going to you know, translate that into the depth or volume that you're trying to get at. And so that's just so much fun to watch and so much fun to teach people.
Yeah, and you know, I have a background in theater, and I'm thinking about set design, and I think the really good sets that I've seen have very little detail at all. But people go away thinking there was a whole lot there. You know, that's sort of what you're talking about. They create that.
Totally, right? Yeah.
And so their mind is really able to fill the scene.
So they do,
that go on.
I hadn't thought of that with theater, but yeah, that's a great point. I've seen wonderful plays where things were very simple, and yet the combination of the set design and the way that actors move through it, you know, really builds a whole world in your head. Just like when you read a, you know, a fictional story or something, and there's a world, and you know, the writer might give you just a few brush strokes, you know, in terms of description, and you're filling in the rest, and it feels three-dimensional and alive, and that's something you're bringing to it. So I think that's a great collaborative kind of feeling, I think, to be able to do that.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about you. You mentioned the idea early on, and I love that. As a science educator, I love the idea of maybe holding off on the naming of something, and because that's our tendency. And then I think when we get a name, like we go, "That's a robin," or a mom and dad will go, "That's a," you know, they'll say they want to spout their knowledge as adults, "That's a robin," and then the kid gets satisfied and they quit looking at it. And so what I wonder is, I love your approach with kids and adults, but this idea of, okay, well, wait a minute, let's just see first. And it's not that important that we know even what the name of it is right now. It's really important that you see what it is, hear what it is, you know, those things. And so I love that. How do you do that in your teaching? How do you get people to play along with you?
That is really hard. And I confess, I love the names of things. I love knowing the names of things, and I love sharing the names of things, especially, you know, you get great names for certain things. And one of my favorites is, you know, there's a fungus called stinky squid. You know, how can you not share that?
All right.
But I think that you're right. It's that the naming of things often gets in the way of the really seeing, really understanding, really connecting with them. And so we work hard at that. And when I'm working with kids, and with adults, really, to get around it. And we do that mostly by saying, look at shapes, look at angles, look at proportions. So the shapes is the big thing. It's really hard to draw something if your idea of what it is getting in the way. It's sort of, I think of as one of the big impediments to drawing, observationally, is that idea that the you know, your idea of, you can wind up drawing your idea of rabbit or your idea of leaf. And it's very different from the reality of it. So trying as much as possible to see those shapes, I think, is a huge one. And lots of tricks. There are lots of tricks for it. Like, one of my favorites with kids is to get them to kind of close one eye and then take their pencil to trace the shapes of things in the air. And when you're doing that, you can't really be sitting there thinking about the name of the thing. You know, you've got to really concentrate. And something about feeling the shape in the air with their pencil helps them to put the shape down on the page. But I think that, yeah, that naming thing is really, really quite tricky. And so it's a discipline that you have to get into, and not an easy one. I definitely have that problem.
No, and I think teachers have that problem, you know, because we want to pass on. But I always tell people when I train them to do, you know, natural science interpretation outdoors, is when I'm working successfully with teachers that have been classroom teachers, is to get used to the idea that we can name it, but that's kind of the reward. What we'd rather do is engage in all the other stuff first. And then I was just thinking about the stinking squid. You know, at some point after you've been looking at it, you can say, well, you know what we call that? We call this a stinking squid. Do you think we know why? And then they've already been exploring it so much that they can come back at you, and it's less about the name, and they're telling you all the things that make it look like a squid, or why somebody called it that. So, yeah, I love that it being, we still need the name, and we still, but it's the only, I always feel like it's only so we, the name is important only so we can share it commonly without having to go through all the description to do it. We can put a name, but if we don't know what it is really, then the name really becomes meaningless because then we don't know how to translate it. It's when the robin looks different, right? You know, when it's a female or when it's after the winter and it has a lot of really warm winter feathers, it looks totally different than the robin that we see in the summer, for instance.
Right, you kind of see it anew when it's not as you expect it to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that idea of the names as being a reward. I think I'm going to have to borrow that one.
You can have it. Erica, this whole thing about you work with kids, but you also train adult volunteers to be able to also work with kids and fourth or fifth graders, because I was an elementary teacher as well as a museum person. They're the sweet spot, I think, in elementary education. They are not primary. They're not quite into their hormones yet. It is just a really great age because they really are smart and they're really thinking. So why are you drawn to fourth and fifth graders and then talking about the relationship with volunteers?
So through this program that I work with, which is was created through a partnership with the Cambridge School Volunteers, which is a nonprofit partner of the Cambridge Public Schools. And so it was just the nature of the program that it was fourth and fifth graders. It's the school that we work with is the Tobin Montessori School. So it's a public Montessori. And I was the woman who came up with this idea, Julie Crosston, had children in this school, and she proposed the plan, and it was fourth and fifth graders. So that was sort of by default, but has been wonderful, because I think I've worked with sixth graders as well. I've worked with kids who are a little bit older. The sixth graders tend to start to be in that self-conscious mode where they're really looking to their friends to figure out if it's cool to be interested in things. The fourth and fifth graders aren't quite there yet, or a lot of them aren't quite there yet. And they are still, even so they're, the classrooms are combined fourth and fifth grade. So they're together. And you can even see a difference between the fourth graders and the fifth graders coming in. But just that they're still open to just being excited about what they're excited about. And so I think that makes a huge difference. But a neat thing in having the combined classes is that we get the kids 2 years in a row. And so the fifth graders have sort of are mentors to the fourth graders. And so they've gotten to be, you know, open to this programming at the younger age. And so there's some continuity for them. And hopefully it carries them into sixth grade and beyond, you know.
And then, so how do you train volunteers? And so I would assume they have some training from before they can go into the school, but maybe not a lot. And so you're asking about well-meaning adults who want to come in and help them, but they may or may not have a lot of skill. So I would assume, Erica, that you're doing two things. You're not only working on their ability to teach the art, but also how to work with kids.
That's true. And let's see. So I have some time with just the adults. It's not a ton of time, but it's some. And so, but Julie and I are working together to kind of introduce them, Julie, more to the teaching end of things, the working with the kids end of things, and me with the drawing part of things, the writing. And so we at least it's the, having the two of us there is very good, because I'm also not, you know, a trained teacher of young people, but I've had a lot of experience with it, and I think I know I can give them tricks to find ways to work with the kids. And one of the things that we emphasize is that every kid is very different coming into this. They're different in their attention spans, in how interested they are in nature, even in how much time they've spent out in nature. And so we're working with the volunteers constantly to adapt structured activities to their child and their child's needs and their child's interests. So it's only a 7-week window, 2 weeks of training, you know, 2 sessions training the adults and then 5 sessions with the kids. But so we pack a lot in there, and I'm sort of with them the whole way. I'm with the, you know, as they work with the kids. So I'm kind of a coach for the students and for the volunteers, just helping them sort of find their way with their individual student, which is one of the reasons it's so great that it's a one-on-one program, the adults with the kids one-on-one.
Yeah, and I can only imagine how having that many adults, you know, moving around the room, helping where there's help needed, or pointing out something that somebody might see differently, how much we need that, and how we have that helps us break from that factory model, which is, you know, a good teacher can handle 30 kids, which they can, but they don't. But it's nothing like right. If I can, the closer I can get to a one-on-one or a one-on-five or whatever it is. So those volunteers, and then you guys being there as a backup professional to help. So I assume some of what you do is you model for them in front of them. If you see something, you will tell a child, but that adult volunteer is hearing you do that and go, like you said with me, you'll borrow it, right? You're hoping that the volunteer right. borrows that idea.
Yeah, and that seems to work really nicely. And I have to say, we have volunteers who come from all different backgrounds, but I am constantly learning from them as well. So it really yeah. goes in lots of directions. And I would say we're all learning from the kids as well. So it's a really nice it's a nice kind of network of, you know, of interchanging of ideas and approaches. And I've one of my favorite ideas that I got from a volunteer who had experience working with kids through Mass Audubon, Massachusetts Audubon. She said it was related to that naming things idea. A lot of times kids know so much about the birds or the insects or whatever it is. And if you get a kid who jumps in and starts naming things and not seeing them, she says, well, you know, so you see there's a robin. How do you know it's a robin? You know, what are the characteristics that it has that makes you know that it's a robin and not an elephant, you know? And it really gets, it stops them in their tracks because they're ready to do that name and go kind of idea. It stops them in their tracks and gets them thinking, ah, okay, what am I really looking at? What am I really noticing?
Yeah, and that's really an interesting thing because you, as an educator, I see a lot of times people, as parents particularly, they want to know that their child's outstanding and they want to know they're smart. And, you know, I think every child is smart and outstanding, but they mm-hmm. specifically sometimes get going with the naming. So they'll have a child who says these things that sound so smart, like conservation of angular momentum. Child will say that. And then what I always found is that if you start to interview and ask the child what you were saying, an in-depth question, they really don't know what they're talking about. They have the language. So they're a language manipulator and it makes them look really smart. They get reinforced for it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're so smart. But they really haven't learned yet what that is. So because it's useless knowledge. So the name by itself is useless. And so it's interesting. I agree with you. I think it's funny. You know, I might be able to name a color, but it doesn't really help me to represent that color.
It is, and it's I think any opportunity you can get to have a kid teach you, and so if they're using that kind of labeling of things without the knowledge, it will sort of force them to dig deeper if they have to yeah. sort of teach you about it. And I have to say, it goes in the other direction. You know, having to teach things makes me have to, you know, think again about how I've described something. Do I really know what I'm talking about? And go and look things up and give it more thought and come back. So yeah, we all need that, I think, sometimes.
Yeah. And I think one of the hardest things to teach too, that you probably struggle with as well is the sequencing. Sometimes we have it down for us, what works for us to be able to draw something. You know, the sequence we go through, but that doesn't necessarily mean that child as that learner needs that sequence. And sometimes we're trying to force our way of doing it down the throats of somebody that they really just find doing it a different way. And so it humbles you and makes you have to think as the educator, how you are, and that's that two-way street. You're learning from them. You're going, oh, well, you might really be onto something here. I had never thought of that.
Right. Yeah, no, it is totally humbling. But it's exciting too, just to see you know, how are they thinking about it? How are they seeing it? You know, how are they making that translation of something from three dimensions to two dimensions? And then, you know, finding ways with any kid to give them a little more confidence or to give them a little bit more structured way of approaching things is sometimes helpful. Getting them to slow down is a big one, right? Because a lot of kids will just like they'll name something and sort of quickly move off. They will sort of scrawl something, even if they know they're capable of a more careful, detailed drawing. So sometimes it's even just a matter of that, you know, getting them to slow down.
So the children that you work with, I would assume it's an urban kind of setting, the school.
And it is, yeah.
Part of what you're doing also, right, is helping them to realize that there is animal and plant life in the city.
Yeah, it's really, it's interesting because we started the program at a school when the school was located next to Fresh Pond, which is a really beautiful nature reservation. Okay. In Cambridge around a reservoir. And so there, even though it's an urban school, we could go right into the middle of this area where there were meadows and ponds and
oh,
all of these things. So that was really great. But the school is being rebuilt. And so we've now been moved to a very urban part of Cambridge. And we've been there for, well, last year was the first year we were in person while they were at that location. We were all remote with the program during the first year of COVID. But it's now so much more urban, and I was nervous about it. I was like, how are we going to keep them engaged? You know, are we going to find what we need, you know, what we need to get them really thinking about these things? But it's been great. It's been really interesting to, one of the ideas that Julie introduced was getting them to think about how animals and plants were working with the built environment around them. So, you know, trying to find nests or perching locations or plants growing through cracks or, you know, we've found so many things like that. And I think it's almost more exciting in some ways to, you don't see everything, you know, you can't find something exciting everywhere you look. You have to look harder. And yeah. So we really, it's a scavenger hunt. It's sort of a treasure hunt.
Yeah, and out in the more what we would term natural, you know, where you're talking about around the pond, yeah. you expect a tree to be there.
Mm-hmm.
What's funny is, you know, seeds go in weird places. They can grow out of a church, you know, off right. the top, you know, in a gutter. They can grow in funny places that you wouldn't expect a tree there, or you wouldn't expect that particular spider to be there or that particular
right.
plant, and yet. That I think that is the exciting discovery of an urban environment.
It really is. Yeah, you really see it, resilience in action, and just the almost the power of nature to sort of to make a go of it. You know, that's
right.
I think it's a little inspiring too.
In the least hospitable places.
Exactly.
It goes on. Yeah, and then I'm sure they see when there's been a building abandoned or whatever, how nature's just slowly taking that thing back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's dissolving it, and it's starting to use it as habitats, and
right.
It's pretty amazing. I guess again, it's helpful for children to understand that, you know, humans aren't that important. Honestly, we think we
yes.
are, but really, nature just keeps going, right? I mean, it's very resilient, like you said, and that is also a wonderful stewardship kind of thing that they're learning, is to care for that environment, that even though humans have a lot of impact, nature still goes on.
That's a great point. Yeah, the reason I got into the whole nature journaling thing was that I met Claire Walker Leslie, who is a wonderful artist and educator and writer. And she, for a couple of years, tried to get me to get engaged with teaching nature journaling because she said it was particularly important for people who could draw to get kids drawing nature so that they could really see it and appreciate it and become stewards. That was her thing. And she said that over and over again to me over a couple year period. It started to sink in, and I went and observed her teaching kids in an urban environment and seeing that. How are they going to feel that they have any responsibility to make even an urban landscape hospitable for nature? If they don't see it or they're not connecting with it.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting, you know, even what we do, even in urban settings, to try to soften it with nature. You know, people put pots on their balconies, or, you know, they even just crave a little piece of land to plant something in. And because somehow softening the building or softening the human side.
And making it feel more a home to us, I think, because yeah, I don't think cement is very homey.
No. Yes. We've been talking with our guest, Erica Bead, about her teaching and how teaching drawing to children and adults helps them slow down and notice the natural world. And please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with our guest, Erica Bead, about how moments of insight inform us about what we're looking at and the joy that comes from owning a drawing skill. And Erica, I can only imagine you as a child, and can only imagine that you must have been one of those that liked to look and was curious. So how did you get into where you wanted to do this as a career?
Well, I think of it as a circuitous path, but then sometimes I think maybe it wasn't really so circuitous. It seemed that way. I've really always loved to draw, and I've always loved nature. When I was little, we lived in an apartment building in Toronto, and so it was a very urban setting, but there was a line of poplar trees behind the apartment building. And my parents used to set me out on the balcony with a pair of binoculars and like a Peterson field guide. And we were on a flyway, so we actually saw pretty nice birds coming through. And I loved to do that. But when I was about 6 or 7, my eyesight started to get really, really bad really quickly. And I didn't find this out until my 20s, but my parents were actually told that I was going to lose my eyesight. Obviously they were upset about this. And my father went out and bought me a set of books that are, they're beautiful sort of oversized coffee table size books of drawings and watercolors by a Canadian wildlife artist named Jay Fenwick Lansdowne. And they're just beautiful. And there was just something so magical about them, and particularly about the drawings. There would be a drawing that was a study for the painting, and then the painting. And there was something about the drawing, the way that it showed the process of getting to the painting, that was really exciting for me as a kid. And my parents wanted me to have this because they wanted me to be able to experience something like this before I lost my eyesight. But thankfully, my eyesight stabilized, and my left eye, my right eye is still pretty lousy, but the left eye stabilized, and so I had certain issues. I'm very nearsighted, and seeing anything up close is very exciting because far away things are hard. But that just getting those books and being exposed to them at a really young age, which I might not otherwise have done, really got me pretty obsessed with the drawing end of things and with the nature end of things. And so I was just one of those kids who always has a sketchbook with them, and I was always sort of lugging it around and drawing everything. So I think that was really a sort of a formative experience that came out of something surprising. But when I went off to college, it was a sort of odd because I went to college, I wanted to double major in biology and art. Seemed like the perfect thing for me. The way that college had the curriculum set up, all the key biology courses were at the same time as the art courses, you know, so you couldn't major in both. There was no way to do it. I guess they just assumed people wouldn't. Those were two things that were not go together. And so I chose art over biology and sort of, lost that piece for a while there, that science piece. But after sort of pursuing fine arts for a while, for going grad school for a year, I really realized that fine arts path wasn't really for me, and I couldn't quite figure out what I was going to do. But then I came upon the Handbook of the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators at the Cambridge Public Library. And that was just a revelation to me. I could just remember standing there looking at it, you know, picking it up off the shelf and looking at it and seeing these incredible images of the natural world, you know, intricate, detailed, beautiful, and also doing something, you know, doing a kind of work and communicating ideas and communicating this wonder about nature. And so I just never occurred to me that that could be a real job anymore. You know, I knew people did that in the 19th century and the 18th century.
Right.
So to find out that being a scientific illustrator was a real thing and that people made a living at it was really exciting and sort of brought all those things together for me. So
did you enroll in more science courses at that time, or?
I didn't at that time. What I did was I found out about the Rhode Island School of Design's continuing education program. They actually have a certificate program in natural science illustration, and I worked with a wonderful teacher there. I actually was working full time and taking the train to Providence to take classes with Gretchen Halpert at RISD, and so I took botanical illustration classes and medical illustration classes with her, and it was just an amazing experience, just to learn to look in that way and to record things, you know, really clearly, really precisely. And I also took classes, just individual classes, at the Harvard Museum of Natural History with Laszlo Mazzoli, who was the scientific illustrator there, and Kathy Brownwing, and learned wonderful techniques of, you know, stippling with pen and ink and mixing watercolor and colored pencils. And so it was just sort of individual classes here and there that got me going. And then on the science front, I just read everything I could at that point. I just, you know, gobbled up all kinds of, you know, popular science books, you know, from, you know, Stephen Jay Gould to all of those wonderful evolution, you know, writers on evolution and biomechanics and all population science, all of those things that are really exciting. Let's see. So yeah, it was just interesting to see everything kind of gel together at that point. And so doing that work was very satisfying.
So there's a couple things that you've said that just really are key to this idea of art and science and the connections between art and science. And one of them was that you were fluid with that. In other words, one fueled the other. So it wasn't as much formal either way. I mean, you got some formal art and you got some obviously science along the way, but it was your passion and curiosity and your freedom to move between the domains without really thinking about I'm doing art now or I'm doing science now. And I think that's probably what the guild did, was that idea that, oh my God, I could be doing both of these things at the same time without having to worry about, am I in one school or am I in the other school? And I think that's powerful. And it goes back to the old idea, I wish we would take our schools back there to that liberal arts and sciences are one. In other words, you know, art, science, history, all those are one thing. And you really just need to be doing that. And
well, very much so.
When you get to a master's or a doctorate, yes, you could specialize. But the point would be, as an undergrad, you shouldn't even be even thinking that you're away. But that's another story. But I love that. Other one I wanted to mention that you just mentioned, and I think it's a wonderful idea to imagine that your parents were so foresighted to bring those big books into the house when they knew you might be struggling with having your eyesight. And in a way, they were unconsciously preparing your brain for the future because you had the luxury of not being born blind, but slowly losing it. But I think it was genius on your parents' part to have imagined that big books of images and things would lay down the foundations in your brain.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah, and it was such a privilege to have that exposure to that to that idea, to that bringing together of art and science really early on. I think that's one of the things that gets me excited about, you know, working with the art and science in one program, is it just feels like, you know, every kid should have that chance to put those things together. I think that even if you don't go into the sciences or you don't go into the arts as a career, it just enriches every day of your life, you know, to be able to be open, to be aware, to be connected to that nature around you, and to find different ways of connecting and responding to it. You know, just, you know, maybe drawing doesn't wind up being your way of responding, but it opens up the possibility of responding in interesting new ways. You know, maybe with music, maybe with, you know, just the activity, you know, hiking or you know, rock climbing or whatever it might be. You know, finding your way to those things.
Absolutely. I think one of the other things that I hear in your own life's journey is that there was this little spark that just stayed in there. And even if somebody probably, I bet, if somebody had tried to discourage that spark, it wouldn't have gotten discouraged. There was something about you that kept driving forward.
Yeah, I think that's true. And it's not, you know, I did scientific illustration for 20 years, and I was never able to make a full living at it. I've always had to have some other kind of work to kind of support the habit of doing that. And I think that you know, that spark is there, is sort of proven by the fact that I can't stop, you know? So it doesn't matter that it doesn't, you know, make a full living. I can do other things, and I can find ways to build it in. And yeah, it's just I can't imagine ever letting that stuff go.
No, and when I was in one of your classes, it was just you do translate it in a way to the students that makes it less threatening. Because I think it's funny, the science can be threatening, but we also forget that illustration and art and trying to draw perfectly can be really frustrating. And I loved your approach, which was really one, again, of trying to get some basic kinds of general things, shape. I don't know if you remember, what really got me excited when I was younger was John Nagy, who was kind of a beatnik, and he had a little tiny goatee, and he had a television show, and he had a learn to draw book. And the very first thing you did was draw all these shapes and then shade them. And then he said you could make anything out of them. And I remember doing that forever. I could make a horse. I could make, because he showed me where the shapes were in it, where there was a cone, where there was. And I thought, right, wow, that just took me to a whole new level as a kid. I was probably eight. About the age 8 to 9, about the age that you're working with.
Yeah, I had those books too. It's just sort of like draw 50 animals, and it's all circles, and you know, it doesn't seem possible. You know, how could you do it with just circles?
How can you make a horse out of just all circles,
right,
and
right,
cones? But you can. And he, you know, he had whole scenes too, like in his little book. There, you know, you would do a whole Mexican scene in Mexico, and you'd have to draw the cacti, and you'd have to draw some buildings and barrels and stuff, but every one of those, it was unpacked as shapes. So he started with those basic shapes, which any of us can get down pretty simply. And then you start to, it's almost like building something on a clay armature, don't you think? You're almost adding it back.
Totally. Yeah, it is. That's sort of how I think of it, is like you're building a foundation of general shapes, and then you're gradually refining and then building on top of that. So it is like, I think it's even helpful to think, oh, I'm constructing something on the page. It takes a little of the magic, the scary magic out of it, the part that's like, how do you even do that?
Right. And you also made me and everybody else in there feel comfortable about that it doesn't have to be perfect. Again, it's what you were getting us to do was representational, making people feel that you were representing it. But more importantly, and it goes back to the heart of what you do and why I now makes sense, you moved into the education side even stronger. And that is that this idea that it's about learning to look at it, to observe, there are more important things than just drawing it accurately.
Right. Yeah. I try to tell people, you know, it's about the process more than the product. And that process of seeing and the way that the act of drawing helps you to see, that's really the thing, the big takeaway in the end. And yeah, that what you get on the paper is much less important. And I think it's sometimes you can see that, because if you go back and look at your drawing, even if you don't, you know, not quite satisfied with how the drawing came out, looking at the drawing takes you back to that moment. It is like a little portal back to a moment in time. And so you almost become aware of how aware you were in that moment of your subject, or that's, even of the sounds around you.
That's really profound. And you're right. It does. You go back and look at that and later. And so that's really cool. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further in conversation with others and your family any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee. Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with our guest, Eric Abid, about our work in art and science in one with the Cambridge Public Schools. Eric, I know a little about you from just our chat. And you kind of go down the path that I do. And I wanted to talk a little bit about nature journaling. And there are all kinds of forms of journaling. You know, there are journaling as a practice for mindfulness. There's journaling that people do, even nature, where you're chronicling something over time. I think about a good friend that we've had on the show before, you know, Robin, who did Cold Canyon in California, the transition of the canyon by fires. And so she had to chronicle every day for that to see the real transition. But you're more like what I do and what I teach, and your journals, why don't you just describe what, when you do, it's not exactly a journal, but I guess it is, but whatever it is, it's a sketchbook. What are you doing within that?
So I have usually sort of one sketchbook that I am using primarily, and it's just a mishmash of different things. You know, some days I'm cartooning in the sketchbook, sometimes I'm doodling, sometimes I'm doing portraits or still lives, or just drawing. I spend a lot of time drawing my dog these days. So it's really a mishmash of different kinds of drawing. But the thing I think that makes it closer, you know, moves it in that journal direction, is that I do like to put the date whenever I work on a page of the sketchbook, because I like to have that context, some sense of what time of year it was, what else was going on in my life. But it's interesting. I've been trying to incorporate, because I teach nature journaling, I've been trying to incorporate a little bit more into it in terms of, also, when I write the date, also try to write the weather, or also try to write the sounds that I'm hearing or something. And I like that, you know, even if you're not doing a formal nature journal, you're giving a little bit of a sense of that context, that environment for your drawing.
Yeah, so it's really about putting down, when it inspires you, whatever is inspiring you at that moment. And I know then you put a date to it, some of them, which is also helpful to you. Do you find yourself going back to these journals?
I do. I love to look through them. Yeah, I have a lot of fun looking through them. It brings me back to different periods in time or to different places. And it's really fun to go look at the old ones. I have a closet that's basically boxes of sketchbooks, and going back to probably high school, early high school. And so it's just incredible the way it can bring you there, and you can see the development of your drawing over time and development of different kinds of ideas.
Yeah, I have a friend where we live that's a poet, Ron Fenn, and he has maybe, I don't know, 40 or 50 journals that he has just kept of his musings, is what he calls them. Sometimes there's poetry in there, Sometimes it's just thoughts that he had. And so he's not exactly journaling. He's creating these books that capture him. And what I found is he was kind enough to let me look at one of them. And he changes color of pen sometimes. He changes between calligraphy and cursive writing, depending on what voice he's working in or whether it's a poem. So when a poem starts, so when you look through his journal, you go, oh my gosh, this is just a window into his brain from the outside. And he loves going back and looking at them. And he's had very little of it published. He was a mathematics teacher at the university level, but he's been doing poetry his whole life. But when he passes away, a lot of his funds are going to go to publishing these things. And I just think it's pretty cool that he's got all this work that he's just been writing and doing. And I can imagine that legacy being left, you know, for whoever looks at Erica Bede afterwards is going to go be able to go back and see these incredible journals of who of your transitions and what you were thinking at different times. I think that's just amazing.
Yeah, I love your description of that as a window into your friend's brain. That's totally what it is. And in some ways it feels sort of, you know, very, very personal, but I love to show them to people. I love to just see people's faces as through them and just, you know, it's hard to share those inner workings but it's great to see what other people make of them.
Yeah, I like the idea. You know, I try to encourage people when I teach them about journaling, I try to encourage them to make it a coffee table book, not formally, but just put them out. Don't just put them in a box and store them for you, but they ought to sit out. And because it's okay that somebody would pick it up and look at it, because it's another form of conversation of getting to know you better, right? And it's a way without, and you're not really touting who you are, because these are not expert works. This is just kind of you. I love
that idea. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we did that with photographs until we got digital. And some people, like my daughter, she still loves going together and taking her digital photos and printing a book for each of she and her husband's anniversaries or each of the birthdays of the children. So she has printed books and they're out. And it does make a difference when you visit her, because you can, while you're sitting there, you're waiting for them to make dinner or you're waiting for something to happen. You just start flipping through these and then you just start finding yourself smiling and having 1,000 questions that you want to ask them. It makes for a more rigorous conversation between them. And so I always think at a party, you ought to have all these kind of like journals around from different people. Bring your journal and just put it out and we'll all just, you know, look at them and then we can have rich conversation.
That's a fantastic idea, Mark.
I like it too. I think, the other thing that I really, really love with what you're talking is it's these habits that you have, that it isn't just that you're chronicling or you're regularly doing it. And it's the habits that you see throughout when you're just sketching, you have to sketch. You get better. I try to tell people so many times, I can give you some techniques and it's fun. You know, along the way, if you want to get really good at it, there's somebody can give you a little trick. But what I love is that I try to get people to understand just by practicing it. It's just like working my bicep just by doing it. I don't care how you do it. I don't have to go to the gym, but just by putting resistance on it, you are making it stronger. And I feel like that with art. Is that the same that you feel? You're just making it stronger by practicing?
I say very much the same thing whether I'm teaching adults or kids. You know, it's that for some reason we have this idea that you know, we have to practice, I don't know, a sport. We have to practice a musical instrument, but drawing somehow either you can do it or you can't. So I tell people, if you could just put 10 minutes a day in, even if you're doodling while you're at work on the phone, even if you're, you know, just put pencil to paper, pen to paper, put some music on, do it while you're watching television. Just getting a feel for the materials, for playing around and seeing how things evolve on the paper. It takes practice, and it is exactly like a muscle.
Yeah, I Yeah, and it is. I mean, it's a lot of really fine muscles that you're trying to get in the hand. I've had to adapt as I've gotten older. I have an essential tremor that developed in my hands, which makes fine detail drawing that I used to be able to do very difficult, because I can't hold the pen still. But that's okay, because I'm doing more expressive, larger kinds of things with my hand that I can do where I use my arm. And I'm also finding digital work to be more possible, because I can control the mouse better than I can holding a pen. And so it's the fact that I have developed those habits over time that allow me to transition as changes are made. And I think about some of the great artists that have done that. You know, I'm thinking about artists who would paint from their bed, you know, and draw on the wall and do different things as they had different stages of their life, or when they lost their color vision, or, you know, but their works continue. And I love that you have that passion, that you yourself, it's not just that you're teaching, but the passion that you yourself, you still have to go back to this medium, no matter what is going on in your life, and you still feel like you have to draw.
Right, and that's true. You do adapt with the times and with your physical capabilities and stuff. I've started to draw with a lot of the time with a magnifying lamp, and it's taken a little while to get used to, but it's just like, I can't see those details anymore, so find a way to do it. Yeah, and definitely drawing bigger is much more, and that makes me draw looser, which is, you know, I have that Scientific Illustrator's habit of preciousness and detail. And so finding a way to kind of loosen up and use larger movements and make things much more energetic and expressive as a result. So you sort of move with it as you change.
Yeah, that's really interesting on those changes in life as well. I want to thank you, Erica, so much. I've been talking to Erica Bead, our guest, really about this intersection between art and science. That's a part of your life and what you're teaching now. I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.